cliffcentral.com.
Stand up for what's right in society, the people who bring about massive change. And one of those people was, of course, Fatima Mir. And we'll talk a bit about her life this morning because there's an interesting memoir that's just been published about Fatima Mir. And her daughter, Shamim, is here. How are you, Shamim? Nice to see you.
Good, thanks. I'm very happy to be here.
Yeah, I'm so happy you could join us and get up early on a Monday morning to be a part of this. Now, your mother, a hero in so many ways, someone who has brought about massive change just by the sheer force of her personality. And obviously she was part of a movement, so it wasn't as if she was there on her own. But we are in a situation now in South Africa where, you know, around the life of another struggle stalwart, Ahmed Kathrada, suddenly we find ourselves plunged into a situation where people are rallying around that one person, even though he's no longer with us. The impact that his memorial service and his funeral had on the public consciousness is just unbelievable. And obviously this is something that your mother could probably relate to very well.
Yes, most definitely. To just say briefly about her, she started as a political activist at the age of 17 when she made her first public speech. It was at a mass meeting at Red Square in Durban. At the time of the 1946 passive resistance campaign against unjust and racial laws. Throughout her life, she has been an activist. And in 1994, like all of us in the country, she had great hopes for the new South Africa. But by the second election, before 1999, she became completely disenchanted. And this was because she was interacting and organizing with communities in Chatsworth. And she talks about, she writes about this in the book. She goes to a meeting and she's very concerned that Indians in KwaZulu-Natal are voting DA rather than ANC. And her mission is to speak to the community members and to say, in a sense, come back to the ANC. And she says to the audience, how can you vote for your former oppressors? And people say to her in response, but we are not concerned about our former oppressors. We're concerned about our present oppressors because the problems we are facing today in the townships around evictions, electricity cutoffs, etc., is being done at the hands of the ANC. So she becomes quite shocked by this response and more aware of the kinds of things that are happening within poor communities. You know, and this is in the formal housing that council has built in Chatsworth, as well as in the shack settlements around Chatsworth. And I'd like to also read, if I can.
Sure, of course.
Something that she says in 2000, because she then becomes very active in working with an organization called the Concerned Citizens Group, as well as with the Durban Social Forum, which has a link to the World Social Forum. And she also becomes involved in Jubilee 2000. So her activism takes on a different form.
She never got tired, huh?
No, she never did. And these are her words. She says in 2001, "Cry the beloved country. Many things have improved since 1994. For one thing, racial laws have disappeared. However, the aspirations of the Freedom Charter, the only historic document that we have registering people's voices and dreams, have not been realized. By the year 2000, we do not have a leadership committed to fighting poverty. We have a corrupt leadership. That is our tragedy. If resources are reserved for only the wealthy, if government shows a commitment only to the middle class, then all I can say is cry the beloved country and cry and cry and cry."
Wow.
And those of us who can shout, no matter how many years we have lived on this earth, we must get up and shout. "I have always stood for the poor and the rights of the poor. And though I and all my friends have been in the ANC for over 60 years, if I have to stand against the organization to address the needs of the vast majority of South African citizens, then I will unhappily do so. We have to be in the process of perpetual revolution to progress and guarantee the rights of the people. I believe we need to strengthen the numerous community-based organizations in our country and increase the voices of civil society. Now, this she writes when she's almost at the age of 80.
Yeah, I mean, this was 10 years before she died.
Yes.
And at a time where probably, if we look back now, things weren't even so bad necessarily when it comes to corruption and the kind of leadership that aren't necessarily listening to poor people. I mean, did she become depressed about this, or did she remain defiant?
She remained defiant and hopeful. And, you know, she had been in I think, 2008, she had a stroke. And 2002, she had a stroke which paralyzed her left side. She was in a wheelchair, but even that didn't put her down. She continued, you know, her feistiness, her resilience, her commitment to achieving the kind of society that all her life she'd been working for never ended.
In the 60s, she organized those vigils. Which made quite a lot of news at the time.
Well, that was around state of emergency was declared post-Sharpeville. Mm-hmm. My father and a range of other political activists were detained. In fact, there were nationwide swoops at 3 a.m, as it usually happens all over the country. I was about 7 years old at the time. And my mum, with other, it was the wives of political detainees, got together, and they had held vigil outside the prison because they were not sure whether their husbands, the men who'd been detained, were going to be moved to elsewhere. And they kept vigil outside, but they also held prayer meetings. Mm-hmm. Phoenix Settlement was a site also of a lot of the women coming together and the protests and, you know, support.
You know, Shamim, one of the things that Mabali and I talk about often is that so often in this country, we focus on the black and white situation. And obviously, a lot of Indian and colored communities have found themselves on the black side of many of these arguments, but not necessarily at the forefront of them. And too much, I think, of the conversation is between the white and the black, and there doesn't seem to be as much interest, or there doesn't seem to be as much emphasis on the struggle of Indian people and of colored people in South Africa, which is as important because very often they find themselves the victims of the same discriminatory laws and everything else. And your mother was one of the people who really brought that fight, along with the solidarity of everybody else as part of the package, to the forefront. I mean, up to then, there hadn't really been, you know, with the exception of great people like Mahatma Gandhi and, you know, when he was here in South Africa, there hadn't really been a woman, an Indian woman, who was as much of a defiant force against the old regime.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, so on the question of Indians, I think, yes, the Indian community in this country faced the brunt of the racist regime, the apartheid regime.
I mean, in some ways,
but
it was almost
not,
like...
Not as badly, though.
No, but sure, but in some ways it was...
The African majority faced, right?
Absolutely.
But still, there were racial laws.
They didn't allow any Indian people at all into the Free State.
No, they didn't. And I think Indians were also seen as a threat to the small emerging Afrikaner business people, you know, the smaller shopkeepers, etc. They were seen as a threat. And so the Free State barred them. In Natal, there was always ways and means to restrict the advancement of Indians who were seen as, you know, I suppose, beginning to amass some sort of capital, even in a small way. And there were measures in place to prevent their advancement. The Group Areas Act, you know, also affected Indian people terribly in terms of loss of land. So there was a whole barrage of laws that Indians had to resist. There was the poll tax. The 1946 resistance that I mentioned was also in response to something called the Indian Representation and Ghetto Act, which was a specific law to restrict Indians. And of course, Indians didn't have the vote. So, you know, we did, as a community, suffer. But I think more in terms of education, health, etc., we were in a better off position than the African majority. But when you talk about women, yes, there are very few women who stand out then, if you're looking at the 40s and 50s. But I think also there are very few women that we choose to remember. And when I say we, I mean the general trend of history.
Absolutely.
Even in the present. I mean, when I look at the meeting that happened on the weekend at the Joburg City Hall, to commemorate Ahmed Kathrada's life, every leader of every organization that came up to speak was a man. So even today, when we talk about women's advancement, when there's more of an awareness of women being in positions of power, we actually don't see that many women. On the other hand, the call for more women in political office is a problem if you only think of gender and don't think of other attributes that people have. Mm-hmm. Because we do have ministers today, like the Minister of Social Development, who's a woman, but who's not doing anything for the needs and interests of the majority of the women in this country. So in people like my mother, and if one can praise one's own parent.
Yeah, of course you can.
There's this thing of not praising one's children, but I'm in the situation of praising a mother. I think not only was she a woman, but she stood for what was right and just. And she was prepared to stand for that, even at the extent of, you know, having her house petrol bombed, having an assassination attempt on her life, being in prison, being banned. I think she had a series of about 4 banning orders, each of which was for 5 years.
I imagine you must have grown up knowing about this stuff early on, because it was such a part of your reality. And you can't really hide from your child that your house is being petrol bombed, or that your mom or your dad is being arrested, or any of those things. So how did she explain it to you as a kid?
Well, my first experience was when I was 3 years old in 1956. My dad was one of the treason trialists, one of the 156 people, along with Mandela, Sisulu, and others who were charged for treason. And he spent at least a year in Johannesburg, initially being kept in detention and then being released. But because a trial happened in Johannesburg, he had to be available and present in Johannesburg. So we as children, and me as a three-year-old, our parents explained to us that this was the struggle to ensure that all people in this country had equal rights, because all were equal, but government didn't deem so. Again, when I was 7, as I said, in 1960, my father was arrested. And it was explained to us in terms of we would drive past the paddling pool at the beach. Mm. And in those years, because of apartheid legislation, we were not allowed to go there. And so our parents said this was a struggle so that all children could go to the beach and the paddling pool.
Well,
and so it was explained to us,
sure,
in those terms.
But I mean, that's probably the best way to explain it to children.
Yeah.
And your mother was able to look after all of you and to raise you, in spite of the fact that she also had all these responsibilities in the struggle and in the movement.
Yes. And, you know, I played a part in putting the book together for final publication. And one of the things that struck me as I was working on her life during the 1956 treason trial was that she was only 28 years old at the time. Her husband was detained away from the family for a year. He had started his law practice. So she is a 28-year-old, is looking after 3 children, trying to secure a job so that she can earn some money to keep the family going. She was not wanting, and she did not take any support from International Defense and Aid, just on a matter of principle. She thought, right, other people were more deserving and requiring of that support. And she, at the same time, she ran my father's office, making sure that there would be lawyers who would come in.
A whole lot of jobs under one person.
Yeah. And so it's when I worked on that section of the book, I just thought how incredible this is, that this young 28-year-old was carrying all of this and managed it, from my perspective as a child then, almost effortlessly, because we didn't feel the brunt of this.
Well, I mean, that just shows again the quality of the character of this person, that she was able to be a good mother, to look after her children, to make sure that they weren't in any way, I suppose, made to feeling insecure about,
exactly,
the fact that their mother was,
exactly,
involved in this, but very much a passionate and determined,
yeah,
person who spearheaded this. Now, she was also in the forefront of the organization that started the Women's March in 1956. It was called the Federation of South African Women, right?
Yes. She was also in an organization set up before that, the Durban and District Women's League.
Did she take part in the march?
No, she didn't. At the time of the march, she was pregnant with my brother, I think it was at the time, and she was not able to attend the march.
No doubt she would have been in the forefront of that too, right?
Yes.
She would have been right up front there with all those women who we now have statues of in Pretoria.
But you know, although she was not there, she did a lot of the groundwork in KZN, which was then called Natal, to enable organization and to enable women from Natal to attend the march.
Now, one thing that your mother and I would have probably disagreed about was Salman Rushdie.
Yes.
she said that it was a good thing that he was banned, and she supported the Iranian Revolution.
Yes.
And she was all for him being called a blasphemer and probably thought that the fatwa was quite a good idea. Now, I mean, as someone who believes in free speech and free expression and the fact that this is a novelist who subsequently has done no damage to anyone, don't you feel that that might have been one misstep in her?
Okay, but can I just say, I don't think she would have quite said it as you did, like he's deserving of the fatwa.
All right, what was her point of view? I'm going to put words in her
mouth. You know, she felt, I think if I can reinterpret, she didn't write about this in the book, so I'm just, you know, surmising that it was more a case of she felt he wasn't sensitive enough to the Muslim community, and rather than he was deserving of the fatwa. And I think with freedom of expression and speech, there's always that murky line, you know, between the freedom and the hurt that you can cause. And I think that's where she was coming from. With the Iranian Revolution, I think she saw it as anti-imperial, so anti the U.S., and she visited Iran just at the start of the revolution and came back feeling very inspired at the kind of changes she saw. But I think she was also shown selectively only certain parts of what was going on, as would happen in any situation.
Well, I mean, from
were you in a government-led
visit? For an activist of women's rights as she was, it must have been disappointing to see that Iran, for many women, has become backwards rather than forwards.
Yeah, I think she would have seen that later.
Yeah, and
she would definitely have seen that.
And theocracy as opposed to democracy, you know, very different things. What it is now is it's run by the mullahs, really.
Yeah. No, and she also grew up, I mean, as a Muslim Indian from Durban, I mean, she grew up in a family where her father was critical of the Maulanas. So there was never a total wholesale acceptance of theocracies or you know, leaders of theology, but always a questioning and a criticalness. And I think what's interesting about the book is that we get a picture of the personal life, growing up in a family where there was always challenge, a family that became involved in the political struggle because her father's brother was the joint secretary of the Passive Resistance Campaign and of the South African Indian Congress, which was an amalgamation of the Transvaal Indian Congress and the Natal Indian Congress. So there were challenging ideas about challenging the state, challenging religion, and then through an aunt or her cousin, there were challenges to the position of women and the subordination of women in society. And so all of this becomes part of her very early consciousness and the construction of herself as a person. So her challenges to, you know, the system as she grew up come from that place. And I think one gets a picture. Hopefully the reader will pick that up. But for me, that's what comes through. So this book is not so much about a struggle hero and the political struggle, but it's about a little girl, her memories from the age of 3 years old, growing up in this family. She calls it an unusual family of one father and two mothers. There are 8 siblings. There's an extended family at any given time. There are about 15 people living in that house. And it's the interaction between family. And the title, Memories of Love and Struggle, are about struggles, I suppose, in the personal arena. And I think one of the struggles is in her relationship with my father, where both of them are equally independent and passionate, both involved in the struggle. And my father, perhaps being a more traditional male, expecting that, you know, the marriage would mean two people coming together with the husband in charge and in control.
And that was never
but finding
that was never
this
the way
was
your
not
mother
going
would
to
behave.
Be. And so you get a sense and a glimpse through letters that they wrote to each other during the treason trial, during the 1960 detention of my father, and through her memories of their relationship. So I think what's interesting for me is that it's the struggle is, in a sense, the backdrop. She lived through those very interesting times. She met very interesting people. My parents were very friendly with the Mandelas. My dad and Nelson were at university together. And coming back to the issue of non-racialism and, you know, Indians in the struggle, it's been recorded that my dad was one of the people who got Mandela and Sisulu to think differently about the, you know, organizing entirely with Africans or solely with African, South Africans, but broadening. To opening up and broadening to linking with other racial groups.
So did you have these people in your house from time to time? I mean, the Sisulus and the
well,
Mandelas.
Well, I have a strong memory of Chief Albert Luthuli, for example, sitting at the breakfast table and admiring a picture on the wall, you know.
What do you remember of him?
Well, that's my one strong memory. I mean, lovely, gentle man.
Yeah.
And just sitting there admiring this photo of women pounding rice, you know, which was up on the wall. And, with Nelson Mandela, Winnie Mandela, and their children who came and stayed with us from time to time. But, you know, it's as if these were just aunts and uncles and their children.
Well, that's a hell of an uncle or aunt to have when he would ultimately become president one day. You didn't know that at the time, obviously. But do you think that in retrospect, your mother had any regrets? I mean, did she express as much about any of the things that she espoused, any of the participation that she engendered? Was it perhaps to do with the fact that in the end she realized that the ANC was turning into something different, and change is inevitable. This is why I get upset with people who think things will always be the same and they'll always have the same kind of constitution, they'll always have the same membership, they'll always have the same sort of ideology. Things change.
I think she had no regret of her role and that she'd given her life to the struggle in this country. Her regret was that she didn't see in her lifetime come to fruit the kind of society she'd expected. She was very disenchanted with the macroeconomic neoliberal policy. You know, GEAR was the initial carnation.
Yeah.
She was very, very disenchanted with that. That was the route government had chosen because it was never going to ensure that the majority of their people had their socioeconomic rights met, you know, decent education, decent housing, and so on. So she was very disenchanted, and as I say, she continued striving to work with organizations to make sure that there would be changes.
And do you think that she was happy at a point? I mean, as 1994 dawned on us, she must have been elated that they'd finally reached a point where it was self-evident that the struggle had borne fruit.
Yes, I think she was, but still with reservations. Because even at that point, I think there were beginning to be signs of struggles within the organizations.
Yeah, what's next kind of stuff. Yeah, and then and jockeying for power.
Yes,
and
jockeying
all of that
for
stuff.
Power.
And she never put herself forward as being one of those people who would take high office.
You know, that's a bone of contention because it's not quite clear what happened. But at the time, just pre-94, she was on the SABC board.
Mm-hmm.
And the story goes that she was on the name of list of ANC members for parliament. But that, you know, the list goes to the NEC, I think, who then finally decide who would be on the list. And it was decided in her case that they preferred her to be on the SABC and not in Parliament. And as I recall it, she was actually upset and annoyed that she was not consulted, that the decision was made for her. Now, others have said that she refused to be on the list to Parliament. So whose version,
ever,
I'm not sure, we
you?
Go with. Well, what I remember is the version I've just said.
Well,
she felt she should at least have had a choice.
Yeah, and perhaps would have made.
And that's the other thing about my mother. She was never, ever I'm going to use the word slavish, party member. You know, because we have this thing in the ANC of towing the party line. And I think now we're seeing with the coming to-do in Parliament, you know, how are ANC people going to vote? Because traditionally it is.
You do what the party wants you to do.
And my mother was never, she was always fiercely independent rather than being a party functionary.
I think she probably would have liked to have made more of a contribution post-1994 as well. And in terms of ensuring that certain communities and groups were looked after.
Yes.
So maybe that was a way for her to have made a difference should she have been in Parliament and instead being in the SABC board. It seems almost second best, you know.
Yeah.
I'm curious, too, as to how the community in Chatsworth... They must have very fond memories of her and must be very grateful for her contribution because that was where her impact would have been felt the most.
Yes, post-1994, post-1999.
Aren't there at least some things named after her in that area?
No, there's a hospital building named after her, but in the area of town where she lived, Overport. Yes.
Okay. Well, I mean, it's something. And you must be proud of this book because it's a real consolidated a memoir, effectively, not necessarily a textbook, but a memoir of her life and her story. And as you say, it's quite intimate and personal. It's not necessarily a historical detailing of this one woman's political career.
Yes, I think it's beautifully written. Again, praising my mother.
And sure.
It's you know, initially, I felt this was really important for us as a family, because she starts off with the Mir family's origins in India, in Surat. And I thought, for the family, for my children, for the cousins, the aunts and uncles, it would really be a good memoir.
But also for the country.
But then I thought for the country as well, because it records a child growing up, coming to womanhood, becoming a political activist, taking a stand within a particular period of our country's history. And a lot of what she went through would resonate, I think, for young people in this country even today. And so I think it is a beautiful collection. I think it's also been beautifully put out, thanks to Kwela and to the others who worked on it. I mean, Libby Lloyd was the editor who worked on this book. Nadira Patel, who worked on the cover, which I think is a beautiful cover. And it's, you know, so it looks beautiful, its content is beautiful, and I think it reminds us of the struggles that we each need to consider in our own lives.
You know what I love about the stuff your mother wrote is a lot of it was historical in terms of its context. So she was very interested in indentured labor, in Gandhi, in the contributions of the Indian community in South Africa to the total history of this country. Don't you sometimes feel that there are so many people looking at now and at where we are at this very moment that there isn't enough appreciation for how deep the roots of some of our biggest problems and our possible potential solutions might be because we're not looking at history in its overall context?
I think that's very, very true. And it's, I don't know whether it's to do with the social media age we're in, where everything is instantaneous and in this present moment, but we need to do a more looking back. And as you say, the other works that my mother has written, she's written profusely, but she wrote on the life of Gandhi in South Africa. She wrote on Mandela. In fact, Mandela's first biography was written by my mother.
That's right.
Called Higher Than Hope.
That's right.
And, you know, she again, with those biographies, she goes deep back into the lives of these people. The other book that she wrote, which is very significant, is The Life of Andrew Zondo, who was a freedom fighter, an MK freedom fighter, who was met with the death penalty. Jeez. And she interviewed Andrew Zondo and wrote this book after having had intense contact with him and his family. And in each of these, you know, she delves into the person's past, the person's historical roots. And I think while we need to understand this for each of us personally, we also need to understand the history of our country and how it is that we got to be where we are today.
Do you think passive resistance was always the best way to go? I mean, she was absolutely the person who brought that into the consciousness of the ANC. because the ANC was a military organization too, and Mkhonto weSizwe played a very important part in how the ANC got to where it got.
Yeah.
But passive resistance was her thing.
Both hers and my father's. He was a member of the Communist Party and the NIC, Natal Indian Congress, and he actually broke with the Communist Party on the question of armed struggle.
Oh, really?
So both of them stood very much for nonviolence as a means of, you know, continuing the struggle.
Do you think in South Africa we would benefit from passive resistance occasionally here too? Here and
you
now.
Know, I wouldn't. I mean, I believe that there are times when one might need to take up more violent means of struggle. But as far as we can, I think we need to also look at the passive. Well, you know, the term passive resistance comes from Gandhi's word satyagraha. When to the English word passive seems to denote that you're not doing anything.
Inert, yeah.
But you actually, you know, it's a form of resistance, right? And of course, there is, having said that, there are some times when violence might be necessary. Doesn't mean that I would say one needs to undertake violent struggle at all times, because I think also the outcome depends very much on what you put in.
Right.
And violence can often just breed more violence. And again, a question we need to look at for our society today, the fact that we did undertake an armed struggle has left us with some forms of hurt that we might not have had otherwise, had the struggle been completely nonviolent, is what I mean. So you pay costs for violence as well, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. I think that passive resistance is underrated as a means of bringing about change. And I think too many people immediately go for the violent because so often that's what you see and that's what you hear and that's what makes the news.
I certainly think we need to look at strategies that are clever, tactics that are clever and that are able to get us the objectives that we would like to get.
Well, congratulations on the book again. I think your mother would be very, very proud of this one. It's a compilation, obviously. She wrote a large part of it. Memories of Love and Struggle is what it's called, Fatima Mir. And what an incredible book at such an incredible time.
Thanks. Thank you very much.
I think a time where we're starting to take stock of the people who brought us to a point where we could improve ourselves. And we seem to have given over that authority to people who are not trying to help us move forward. They're trying to pull us backward, and we need to go back to the foundational documents here.
Thanks.
Thank you so much, and congratulations. There we are, Fatima Mir and the book called Memories of Love and Struggle. And thank you so much, Shamim, for coming in to speak to us this morning too. Pleasure to meet you. Shamim Mir, the daughter of Fatima Mir, and part of our lineup for today. A great discussion around this book. You can go and get it at good bookstores. CliffCentral.com.